You've written that for the British public, the Great War is not mere history, it is living reality. Why do you think that the First World War is still so relevant and still captures the fascination of people today in the 21st century?
Well, I don't like the word relevant for a start. I think relevance has nothing to do with it. What it is about is people's interest. And people are interested for a number of reasons. Family interest, I mean, genealogy, of course, is a very big interest at the moment. The fact that it is taught at schools, both in English and in history, and the fact the media has an obsession with it. So we're just speaking just a few weeks after Remembrance Sunday, and on Remembrance Weekend there were a whole series of radio and television programmes. People can't escape from the First World War.
So moving on, what do you think were the major consequences of the War for Britain?
The consequences of the War for Britain were absolutely enormous, whether they be political, social, economic, or indeed military. I don't really know where to start with that one. At the very least, I think that the First World War changed British society profoundly forever, not least in bringing about the downfall of the, if you like, the existing order, and creating a situation where, for example, I think the Labour Party made electoral breakthrough, which probably wouldn't have happened without the war. There's also the suggestion that's been made a number of times that it brought about the end of deference in British society. Well, actually, I have some doubts about that. I think British society is still fairly deferential in the Second World War, but it is less deferential than before. My own studies recently have moved on to the British Army of the Second World War, and I am very struck by the way that many of the officers of the Second World War found it necessary to adapt their style of command, and many people who in the First World War would simply have put up with whatever orders were being handed down from the army, in the Second World War were much more questioning, much more bolshy, I suppose would be the phrase of the time. Politically, I think Britain's position as an empire was seriously weakened, although not fatally weakened. That took another war to finish that off. We can see all sorts of instances of this. The 1921 Washington Naval Treaty, for example, I think is a symbolic moment at which the American challenge to British hegemony across the world occurs. And we see many of the themes in the political and social history of the First World War reinforced and given further impetus by what happens in the Second World War. So this is a 30-week lecture course on the consequences of the First World War for Britain. But I think they're absolutely enormous and we're still living with them today.
But saying that, you have written that we experience a type of historical amnesia concerning the First World War and our remembrance of the First World War. Could you expand on that?
What I meant by that was what is for me one of the salient points of the First World War, that it was a war that was forced upon Britain by its enemies, principally Germany, that it was a war which ended up as a struggle between liberal democracies and dictatorial autocracies, and it's a war which Britain won, has been airbrushed very largely out of the public imagination. Though I must actually say it has been put back in recent years, not least because the media has tended to turn to revisionist historians, people like me, if only to give a slightly different slant on the usual take on the First World War. And I think all this is incredibly important. To understand the context of the First World War, we've got to recognise that this was in many ways an old-fashioned sort of war, the sort of war that Britain had fought many times before. It was a war over the balance of power. Britain did not wish to see one individual state become overmighty in Europe. So in that sense, Britain fought Germany in 1914 for precisely the same reasons that England had fought the Spain of Philip II in the era of Elizabeth, while Britain had fought Louis XIV and Napoleon when the French were seeking to dominate Europe. For that matter, why Britain was to go to war again in 1939 against Germany, and why Britain was to join NATO in 1949. So there's, in that sense, the First World War is very traditional. What I think is also needs to be borne in mind is that this, whatever it started out as, it did end up to a degree as a war of ideologies, in which you had a clash of, I would argue that liberal democracy, albeit flawed, albeit imperfect, actually came up against a very unpleasant, aggressive state in the form of Imperial Germany, And had Imperial Germany won the First World War, democracy would have been stamped out in Europe, and we would have ended up with a situation which would have been very similar to that which would have happened had Nazi Germany won the Second World War. The major difference being that the Germany of the First World War was not consciously genocidal. I'm certainly not comparing Imperial Germany to Nazi Germany in that sense, but it would have been bad enough for those unfortunate enough to be under German rule. And for that matter, Britain, if it had been defeated on the continent of Europe, I think it's unlikely Britain would have been invaded, but it's entirely possible their armies would have been defeated. Or for that matter, if it had stayed out of the First World War, as some historians would have you believe should have happened, Britain would have faced a very dark and difficult future, and it would completely change the ideological complexion of the world we live in today. All of this is hugely important, and the fact that the British, the Allies, but with the British playing a major part, won the First World War, and the British Army, in my view, played the primary lead in winning the First World War in 1918, is something which has vanished from our collective memory, which I think is a great shame. I mean, certainly it's been one of the aims of my work to try and remind people of those realities.
The military history seems to have been something that has slipped from consciousness now in the First World War. Do you feel that the disillusionment literature, also say the war poets and Goodbye to All of That and Sassoon's biography, etc., has played a part in that and has had an effect on the way that the First World War exists within modern memory, if you excuse me using a fussle term there?
I wouldn't say the military history has slipped out of the public memory, but the sort of military history which tends to dominate and people tend to read tends to be written by non-professional military historians, by journalists, by popular historians, and for a very long time, certainly reaching back to the late 1950s, they have pushed one certain line, which is of, you know, the famously captured in the phrase lions led by donkeys. And so many of the books which basically have no reputation whatsoever among professional historians today, people like Leon Wolff's In Flanders Fields, A.J.P. Taylor's History of the First World War, or at least the military bits of it, and most notoriously of the lot, Alan Clark's The Donkeys, are amazingly still in print, still being read, and people still believe them. What has happened in the last 20 years in particular is that academic historians have started to investigate the military history of the First World War, have looked at the documents, have gone away from the sort of glib certainties presented by some previous authors, and they have come up with a rather different view of the First World War, one in which the British Army starts from a very low base, actually develops to become an extremely effective fighting force, at the cost of huge casualties, it must be said, but that's true of any army in the First World War. Now, I would not for one moment claim that all historians are in agreement on this. Some archivally based historians do take a very dim view of the British Army and Haig. I don't happen to agree with them. I think the majority of scholarly historians don't agree with them, but there is that disagreement. But to come back to your original, the other part of your question about the literature of disillusionment and so on and so forth, I think it has had a big impact. But we need to be aware of several things. The first is, of course, is that even when in the classic Great War Books boom of 1928 to roughly 1933, the literature of the disillusionment were not the only books that were being produced. There were a very large number of books which were either ambiguous about the war or even mildly positive about the war that came out. So, for example, at the same time as you're getting Goodbye to All That, you're getting Charles Edmonds, which was the pseudonym for Charles Carrington's book, A Subaltern's War, which takes a rather more ambiguous, more nuanced approach to the war. And yet, it tends to be the literature of disillusionment which have conquered people's minds. But I wonder if that's not very much a post-Second World War development. Certainly, from my reading of the literature of the time and the way it was received, not everybody in the 20s and 30s bought into the disillusioned view by any means. A very interesting case of this is R.C. Sheriff's Journey's End, a play which I'm very fond of. Now, Sheriff was not a pacifist. I don't think it's a pacifist play. To the end of his days, Sheriff was proud of his service in the East Surrey Regiment. And yet, the original production of Journey's End was staged by, I believe, the director or the producer was a pacifist, and it can be presented in a very pacifist form. Equally, I think you could do a form, you could do a version of Journey's End which has a rather different spin on it. And one thing which has always struck me is at the very last scene of Journey's End, when the dugout collapses and the Germans attack and the implication they're all going to be killed, the original audience would have known that the 21st of March 1918, which is the last day of the play, actually is the beginning of the end of the First World War. In the sense, it's the beginning of mobile warfare, and the Allies go on to win that war. I suspect that most people who watch Journey's End today don't have a clue about that. They simply don't have the context. The audiences of the late 20s and 30s did have that context. One particular wartime officer, later a novelist, and BBC's first disc jockey, Christopher Stone, I edited his letters a few years ago, was anything but a pacifist. He never completely rejected the First World War. He was never anti-Hague in his later years. He went to see Journey's End and was very impressed by it. Someone like that was quite capable of placing Journey's End into a wider context. I think today we've lost that context very largely.
You do write in Forgotten Victory that the poems of Sassoon, Owen and the like provide at best a very limited and skewed view of both the war as a whole and the experience of the frontline infantrymen. Could you expand on what you mean by that?
Well, yes. What I'm not claiming is that any of these poets, or indeed any other poets, lied or bore false witness about their own experience. But it is their own experience they are writing about. And to attempt to extrapolate from a handful of necessarily unrepresentative individuals, the mere fact they're officers, Rosenberg, I think, the principal exception, the mere fact that they're officers makes them untypical of the British Army as a whole. The fact they're middle class makes them untypical of the British Army as a whole, which is an overwhelmingly working class body. The fact they had privileges, all sorts of things. I really don't think you can read any of these great war poets, and they are great war poets, and think that you've got a good view of the ordinary soldier in the British Army. The ordinary soldier in the British Army was a working class infantry private of very limited horizons, who enjoyed none of the luxuries available to the officers in their dugouts. That's the nature of the British Army in the First World War. It was a class-based army, and with the enormous responsibilities of officers, and please don't underrate the degree of the crushing burden of responsibility that they had, came a number of privileges which were simply denied to most soldiers in the ranks. So by their very nature, poets are unrepresentative.
But the actual things that the poets write about, the mud, the blood, the death, the shells, the whole experience of being there in the First World War at that time is very moving and quite harrowing, and to divorce that almost and say they're not representative, that it's the expression that's different between those who are maybe less educated and those who are more educated, as opposed to the actual experience.
Well, I'm not saying that being shelled is any less pleasant for an officer than it is for another rank. That's not my point. You can read any number of memoirs, letters and diaries by soldiers of all ranks, and you pick all of that up. My point is about their reactions to it. Now, my big problem with using war poets as evidence of the British Army of the First World War in general, now I'm not saying most academics do this, but believe me, a number of school teachers do this, and the school teachers are the one who have the real influence over young minds, is that if you take a highly atypical, two highly atypical individuals, Sassoon and Owen, you would think that the reaction of the average British soldier of the First World War was to denounce it as being, you know, a monstrous crime, or to have a nervous breakdown. Actually, neither of those is true. If you look at the morale of the British Army in the First World War, and there's a good deal of research on that now, and anybody can go to the Imperial War Museum and read their way through the documents of private soldiers and so on and so forth. The morale of the ordinary British soldier in the First World War was amazingly high throughout the war. It was resilient. Now, what I mean by that is not that necessarily people were laughing and joking and cheering throughout the war. Clearly, there were some very grim times. But they had that inner resilience which enabled them to keep going. And that is a very different set of reactions to the reactions of Sassoon and Owen, who had very traumatic wars, and I'm not knocking them in any way, shape or form, merely pointing out their reaction was not typical in the least of the British soldier in the First World War. So if you want to get a reason, if you want to choose somebody who I think is more representative of the British soldier in the First World War, I would suggest someone like George Coppard wrote a book called Machine Gun to Cambrai in the 1960s, which is about stoicism, it's about enduring, it's about just getting on with life. That is far more typical than Sassoon or Owen.
What is your opinion on the literary specialists that have been writing a number of works that have been classed as quite seminal over the past 20, 30 years? What do you feel their effect is on the actual perception of the First World War?
I'm a strong believer that a total war, like the First World War, deserves total history, which means we should examine the political history, the military history, the cultural history, the social history, and so on and so forth. And I'm all in favour of people who build bridges between various aspects of history. My problem is that some of the older generation of literary or cultural historians were inclined to make sweeping statements about political and military history based on a knowledge of the literature, which I think is highly misleading. So, for example, Paul Fussell's Great War in Modern Memory, which is a seminal text for literary history, actually really gives, I think, a very misleading view of the military and political history of the war. One of the very encouraging aspects in recent years has been the number of younger scholars who are equally at home in both cultural and military history, who can bring the two sides together. And I think we're going towards a much better synthesis these days, which is producing something close to this idea of total history. And I think that can only be good. But certainly, if you read some of the great cultural historians and think that you have picked up on the military and political history of the war, very often you are sadly mistaken.